Good afternoon, everyone. I'm a little winded and somewhat jet lagged. I hope you won't mind if I at least start off sitting. As the adrenaline gets going, I'll probably spring to my feet. A number of years ago, before I started working full time for the Simon Wiesenthal Center and was still primarily working for Yeshiva of Los Angeles, doing what I really trained to do when I was learning back in Kollel, a fellow came to me with an unusual story. He had recently gotten back from Japan. He grew up in Texas in a large and vibrant Reform synagogue where he felt very disaffected from Judaism. He got the impression that Judaism was all about functions, large edifices, but there was one thing that he desperately wanted that he thought was desperately lacking, and that was spirituality. He figured this out while he was in high school. Spoke to the rabbi, didn't get anywhere. He determined that as soon as he graduated high school, he was going to do something about this and find true spirituality. As soon as he graduated, he got on a plane, went to Japan, and tried to enroll as a novice in a Buddhist seminary. He shopped himself around for a while, and he actually got accepted. And for the next 6 months, 9 months, he was an Olam Haba. It was great. He was experiencing true spirituality. And then the world came crashing down upon him. In high school, he played football. While playing football, he sustained a knee injury. And his knee injury started acting up. And because of it, he had trouble maintaining a kneeling position for hours at a time, which was required in this Buddhist seminary. So he had to leave. He went to his master and begged. His master took him on for a while as a private student, but it didn't work out in the long term. Meanwhile, his family back in Texas is trying to figure out how they're going to reclaim their son. And they went to the rabbi and they said, "Rabbi, is there nothing in Judaism which is spiritual?" Now, I'm just telling you the way he told it to me. He said, he thought, and he thought, and he thought, and he said, "Oh yes, there is one rabbi in the world who has a spiritual message connected with Judaism, and he's in Los Angeles. I've lost track of him. He was a very, very fine fellow, deep fellow, not shomer mitzvot, but a wonderful Jewish heart and a very spiritual neshama. He ran a program in L.A. that was so successful that after a while he started an educational program. And the family communicated with their son. They finally convinced the son to come back to Los Angeles and enroll full-time in this program, which he did. So he came to me a few months later complaining that although he enjoyed the program, there were no real full-time people in it, and he quickly exhausted the offerings at the highest level. So I asked him to describe to me what the highest level course given in the Reform Movement's Spirituality Institute was about. And he said, "Oh, it's called Sfas Emes." And then I realized that there's something terribly wrong with this picture. Here this fellow had to leave Texas search of spirituality, which he knew did not exist in Judaism, get brought back to the United States with the promise that there's one person in Reform Judaism who can offer something of real intense spirituality. And what is it? The Gera Rebbe. We've had a problem for a while. We realize that we've had a problem for a while with many, many people who are intense spiritual seekers. And we're so uncomfortable speaking the language of spirituality when we have so much of it right on the shelves of our own libraries. We're embarrassed by things like the Kabbalah Center, and we should be. We should be. It's beyond phony. But at the same time, we recognize that there are people who are really looking for something. You agree? Good. You missed the entire point of what I'm going to do for the next hour. This is all a good come on. And it's all true. But the people who are most in need of spiritual connection today are not Reform kids in Texas. They're us. There is such a thirst within our own Orthodox community for the language of spirituality, for a conversation with the Ribono Shalom, for feeling that I feel different after a mincha or a shacharis or getting up from a sefer of learning or walking away from a Shabbos table, that I know what it's about, that I have a personal relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that I feel the inner content and the inner language of the mitzvahs that I am committed to, that I ask questions about, that I am moser nefesh for, that I give of myself and my time and my effort to practice. I'd like something more. Ladies and gentlemen, I thank you for joining me, and I thank those who arranged this conclave to give me 1 hour of unadulterated, no agendized, just pure Torah. That's all we're going to do in the next hour. Just learn. And I hope I will not insult your intelligence if you know all of this material. What I would like to do is whet your intellectual palates by introducing you to a couple of Sfarim. If I had more time, I would enlarge the list. I will be sort of conservative and stop at two authors, two Mechabrim, whose work I think will not only revolutionize your relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, could change the quality of chinuch. I don't know how many of you were here last night. No, Rabbi Lau and I traded words, but there's a lot of what Rabbi Lau says that I agree with. When Rabbi Lau touched on certain themes like beyond our responsibility to other Jews, but our responsibility to the rest of mankind. How many people in the entire Orthodox community, whether you're talking about the modern Orthodox world, whether you're talking about the thinking Haredi world, who are so troubled about where we stand in relationship to our non-Jewish friends or the rest of humanity. And there are certain works out there that could revolutionize our chinuch. I would like to speak today about two of them, Rav Kook and the Slonim Rebbe. I think that both of them, in different ways, address the quest for spirituality, enlarge our vision of what the Torah has to say. And I'm not going to give you a lot of historical context. You can go home and check it out on Wikipedia. I would just like to share with you a couple of pieces, two from Rav Kook, one from Nesiv HaShalom, from the Slonim Rebbe. And my only hope is that you get interested enough to say, I need more of that. And then twist the arms of people in your community to help you access them. Of the two, there's no question that Rav Kook is far more difficult. And one of the reasons and excuses that people have for not learning him more often, it's not going to work. It's not going to work, ladies and gentlemen. We have other Sfarim that are absolutely essential, that are just as difficult. The first time you open up Ramban on Chumash, you say, I'll never understand a word of this. But you can't be a properly fulfilled thinking Jew without acquainting yourself with most of the content of Ramban. Get over it. You have to master it. After the first couple of attempts, you pick up a little more. It's the same with Rav Kook. I am going to make a suggestion. Absolutely. Read my lips. I said it. They do. They apply equally to women. Yes. Nesivah Shalom happens to be popular, like, all over the world today. When I was young, which is about 400 years ago, the sefer that was the rage that everybody was learning was Michtav Me'elio. It was like the Bible in Michlala. Every single girl I dated, and I think I dated every girl in two successive years, and I memorized Michtav Me'elio. Today, wherever you look, it's amazing. No matter what they're wearing, Shtreimlich, Kippot Surgot, black velvet yarmulkes, everything. Everybody's learning the Nesivah Shalom today. It has touched a chord. I'll get back to that later. Rav Kook hasn't made it yet, probably because it's so difficult. If you remember only one thing of this afternoon, is this. If you want easier access to Rav Kook than some of the other Sfarim, the ones whose names you're more familiar with, I am going to recommend a sefer that Rav Kook worked on most of his life, on and off. Never finished the whole thing, but what he left was an absolute gem. It's called Ein Ayah. Ein, Aleph Yud Nun, Ayah. It is his running commentary on Shas, on Agados, on Agadot of Shas. He only finished a few Masechtot, about three. I forgot how many volumes out. They used to be very hard to get, not so hard to get anymore. But it is a tad easier to follow than Orot or some of the works that you hear more often. I am going to present two pieces, one from Ein Ayah, one not from Ein Ayah. One from, the first piece I'm going to give you is from Olat Riyah, which is his commentary on the Sidur. Two fat volumes of the most beautiful Torah thought that you've ever seen on the Siddur. I'm going to take you ahead. I hope the women aren't getting too nervous and thinking that I got to run home and start preparing for Pesach already. You know, we don't do that till Hanukkah. But I'm going to share with you in sort of running commentary, not going to hand out the sheets and run through in translation. To go through the piece just to translate the words would take far longer than the hour that we have. So you'll have to forgive me. Any mistakes that I make in the presentation are mine and not his. Halachma Anya. We begin the Seder with it. I don't know. If I had a journalist sitting at my table, I'd have a hard time explaining this. You make Kiddush. And then we're ready for the drama. This is the point where in the Woody Allen movie, people start slugging it out and trading insults, and somebody's saying, "Where's the soup?" The first thing that we do is say, "Oh, this is the bread of affliction, of poverty, whatever. Whoever wants to join us, kol dichtin yesei v'yechol." Now you invite people? When the door is closed and everybody's sitting around the table, this is the time that you invite people? Does this make any sense? Okay, so a few of you have Terutzim, you have Torah. I've never heard anything like what you're about to hear. You may disagree, but this is beautiful, and many of the people at my table have reacted the same way. You ready? Okay, put on your seatbelts. I'm going to read the first line. I'm going to read a couple of lines here and there. So you figure, right, he's going to ask the question to get to the answer. Listen to the first line of commentary to this. Shnei drachim yishanim lehitaluto v'romamuto shel kol koach chayim ma'asi. Huh? There are two distinct paths to the elevation of all practical human kochot. What does this have to do with Pesach? What does this have to do with Matzah? It's the beginning of a psychology lecture. Right? Yep. This is one of the reasons that we love Rav Kook, because the themes that we have to grapple with as moderns, the issues of universality, of psychology, of war, of freedom, all find rich expression in Rav Kook, and I don't know anyone else in the last 100 years who dwelt on those themes. I would be, as a Kirov professional, out of business without Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, who did the same thing, although not in a spiritual way, and Rav Kook. Rav Kook continues. There are two distinct pathways for the expression, for the development of those kochot, of those forces that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created within us as part of the human psyche. He calls one of them the expressive and the other one the restraining force. Let me give you a mashal. You have a child in nursery school. I hope your children and grandchildren do not go to the kind of nursery school I'm about to describe. So little Johnny is sitting drawing with crayons, and there's this, you know, kind of green and purple blob in the middle of the page, and the teacher comes over to Johnny and says, "Oh, Johnny, that's very nice. What is that?" And Johnny says, "That's my Ima." And the teacher says, "That's your Ima? That doesn't look anything like your Ima. Your Ima isn't green and purple." So Johnny doesn't look very happy. The next day, Johnny's drawing again, and there's another different colored blob, and the teacher comes over, and, "What is that?" "Oh, that's my house." The teacher says, "No, you can't use those colors for your house, and your house has straight lines." And what happens? What happens to Johnny's creativity after a few months of this? It disappears. It disappears. It gets extinguished entirely. Okay? Rav Kook says that there are certain forces that start to grow within us. They're part of our psychosocial development. And when allowed and nurtured, they will grow and they will mature and they will evolve. Right? If you restrain them, what can you do to them? You can extinguish them. Right? Let me give you a sadder example. Sally is a very loving child. Her mother is not. Every time Sally goes over to her mother and tries to hug her mother pushes her away. What happens to the love and affection in Sally? Also gets extinguished, right? Let's say it's a little worse than that. Not only does Sally's mother push her away, but if Sally is disappointed or hurt, and Sally yells something in anger, Sally's mother yells back, "You will not get angry in my house. You will not raise your voice." If Sally's mother persists long enough, will Sally learn not to yell? Sure. What happens to the anger? Where does the anger go? The anger is not extinguished. Unfortunately, we know that not only isn't the anger extinguished, but the anger sits there longer and longer and longer, and it builds up. Till one day, Sally becomes a parent, and Sally winds up doing the same to her own children, or abusing her children, or what have you. You've seen the scenario before. Says Rav Kook, what is true on the individual level
of there being forces that can develop, and there are other forces that restrain and hold back. What's true of the individual is true of the collective. Okay? Following? What's true of the individual is true of the collective.
Let's go back to the beginning, to the childhood of our own people. The first person who created within the Jewish psyche an important national force was Avraham Avinu. Each one of the Avot, each one of our forefathers, our patriarchs, was responsible for a different divine force, gift, part of the national treasure of the Jewish neshama. Avraham Avinu's contribution was chesed. Was chesed. What would have happened to the chesed of Avraham if allowed to develop historically among his children, his descendants, over hundreds and hundreds of years? Well, chesed is a force that can get more mature, more sophisticated, and it would have proceeded along a certain trajectory, becoming richer yet. Something happened to stop that. And what was that? Mitzrayim. Paro, in enslaving us, essentially sought to suppress the gifts that the Avot had planted within the Jewish soul and hoped to quash them entirely by the subjugation, by living an intensely non-Jewish lifestyle. And that was the koach ha'atzira, the holding back, that would prevent the Jewish people from developing like they should have. What was the mistake that Paro made? That there are certain forces that when you quash them, do not get extinguished, but actually concentrate themselves, readying for the time when they can boil over and explode into action. He says, think of what Avraham Avinu planted within us. The chesed of Avraham meant not only to give a few wayfarers, a few Arabs, a generous meal, but what it meant was to bring to people, all of the students, all the people who he affected, to bring them the gifts of a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The language he uses is just so beautiful. He says he would give them the chefetz ha-chofesh ha-elim ha-nizgav, the ham-asher es ha-nushius kula, that which enriches all of mankind, umotzia min hashiflut habzuya, and removes them from degrading lowliness shel shibud ha'elilius. The ultimate chesed of Avram was to liberate people from the ultimate subjugation, which is to be in the thrall of gods that are not gods, of pagan deities and the lifestyle that they demanded of people. V'shal ha'avdus shel ha'kfira v'ha'chomrius ha'shfela admaod. And the subjugation, the real servitude to the denial of the divine and to coarse materialism together. And he would do this b'chaye ha'yachid, in the life of the individual, b'chaye ha'mishpacha, in the life of the family, b'chaye ha'medina v'hamamlacha, in the life of the country, uv'chaye ha'tzibur ha'enoshi b'chlolo, and in the life of the entire human family. Now, forget about where I'm going with this. I'll get you back in a second. Where are you going to find in Torah literature anyone using language like that, talking to us about how Torah is expected to enrich us on so many different levels. That Torah has a message, and an enriching, liberating message for individuals, for families, for communities, and indeed for the entire world. Just this one line, and it's not the only time Rav Kook uses it. If this were part of our curriculum, of what we were exposing ourselves and our children to, what a different message we'd be broadcasting to ourselves and our community about our relationship with others. Anyway, by now you've been able to figure out the next point of Rav Kook, but not the end yet. What happened with Paro's experiment? What happened with Paro's experiment? He tried to keep the lid on the development, the nurturing of the Jewish neshama for a couple of hundred years. And as soon as the gates of liberation were opened, what happened? Says Rav Kook, at that moment, the chesed of Avram that had been held latent within us for hundreds of years exploded in force. Lech techa charai b'midbar be'eretz lo zruah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Ko amar Hashem, I remember chesed me'urayich. But the chesed didn't stop there. Chesed went on. We don't have time for that. We do have time for this. Let's get it back to Halach Ma'anya. Says Rav Kook, you sit down at the Seder. The first thing that you do is make Kiddush. As soon as you make Kiddush, invoking the Kiddushat Hayom, the holiness of the day, and you realize that this night is different from all other nights, and the Orot from Shemayim are different today than any other day, and what you taste is not commemoration of freedom, but you taste the Orot of freedom itself. The very first thing you are conscious of, as a Jew, says Rav Kook, is you are put in touch with the first part of the Yerusha, of the inheritance we have from the Avot. The first thing that you become aware of is your capacity for chesed. And you realize, this is a dumb time to be inviting people, but the words can't be kept within. You're conscious of that chesed. You put back in touch with your primal Jewish neshama. So you say, Ko Tichfin, whoever is hungry, yesei v'yechol. Now listen to this. Rav Kook says that when Jews discover who they are and they're put in touch with this heritage of what they have, what do Jews try to do? When they find out within themselves the capacity of giving and sharing. So what do Jews do? They try to create a world in which there's no hunger. They build hospitals. They address political issues to make sure that there aren't starving children here and there. They try to create a better world for everyone so that no one need know deprivation or want. And there are parts of the Jewish world which call that Tikkun Olam. And we sometimes make fun of it for two reasons. The phrase Tikkun Olam in Kabbalah does not mean doing good acts. It means repairing the world at the Shoresh, in the upper worlds, not in Ma'asim Tovim here. That's just a wrongly co-opted phrase. But besides that, present company excluded, when we look at the actions of people outside of our community, there are many among us who say, well, those benighted Jews who don't have access to Torah and mitzvot, so they think that they're going to gain Olam Haba. They take all of their charitable inclination and they squander it. I mean, it's nice, no, but it's not what Jews are for. We should be working to build up our own community. That's only because these poor people don't have any connection with real Torah, so that's all that they can do. What does Rav Kook say here?
Rav Kook says that the inclination to make the world a better world, to end privation and hunger, is the quintessential expression of the chesed of Avram. It's a very Jewish thing. It's a very positive thing. But, there's a but. What's the next line in Halach Ma'anya? Kol ditzrich yesei v'yifsach. Says Rav Kook, the tragedy is that there are many Jews who think that the Jewish capacity for sharing, for chesed, is best achieved by making sure there's a chicken in every pot and a car in every driveway, and believe if every child around the world would have a roof over his or her head and food in their stomach, there would be universal peace. Brotherhood and cooperation would break out over the face of the globe. Says Rav Kook, that's not the end of the Jewish message. It's only the end of the Jewish message who don't know the fullness of Jewish chesed. Precisely at the point that you're answering the needs, the material needs of people, when there's nobody hungry anymore, when you've fulfilled all their needs, what do we say? Kol ditzrich. Whoever needs, now come and have the Karban Pesach with us. Because precisely at the moment that all your material needs are fulfilled, what do you realize? That's only half the story. That you are very much needy, even when there is nothing that pains you, nothing you feel deprived of, but your neshama feels deprived. Having those material blessings doesn't fulfill you spiritually. The ultimate chesed of a Jew is to be able to bring to the individual, the family, the community, the country, and the world, the message of Pesach, of a connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The richness of knowing HaKadosh Baruch Hu, feeling close to Him, feeling part of Him, that's the next step in Jewish chesed, to be able to share that with the world. So in summation, what Rav Kook manages to do is to take a piece in Halach Ma'anya with a question we've all had, provide an answer, in the course of that, put the entire Jewish community, the Jewish soul, our relationship with the rest of the world in a very different perspective. I'm going to turn to another piece. This one is indeed from Ein Ayah, his commentary to Agada, a Gemara in Shabbos. I imagine some of you have seen it before. Amar Rava bar Machasya, Amar Rav Chama bar Gurya, Amar Rav. Hanosein matana lechaveiro. If one gives a gift to someone else, tsarech lahodio. You should let him know. If you're going to give a gift, don't give it anonymously. Attach a card. Let him know who they're getting the gift from. Shenemar vadat ki ani Hashem mekadeshchem. Because the Pasuk says that when Shabbat was given to the Jewish people, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, they should know that I am Hashem who sanctifies them. Tanya nami hachi, ladat ke'ani Hashem mekadeshchem, amalei HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'Moshe. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Moshe, matana tova yesh li bebeit gnazai, v'shabbat shema. I have a wonderful gift in my treasure trove. Shabbos is its name. Va'ani mevakesh litna li Yisrael. I'd like to give it to the Jewish people. Lech v'hodiyem. Go out and tell them. What does this mean exactly? Was there any mitzvah that Moshe didn't tell them? If they didn't tell them, they couldn't practice it. What's the nature of telling them that this is a gift that they're about to receive? Mikan amar v'shem gamliel hanotein pat l'tinok. If you give, do not do this at home. If you give a cookie
to a child.
Tzarech lehodia le'imo. You should tell the child's mother. Now, to the mothers here, what does that mean? You don't want strangers giving cookies to your kids in the playground. Right?
First of all, you never know what they'll lace those cookies with in today's society.
Second of all, you don't want people giving your kids cookies, you know, like an hour before dinner. Right? That's the way we'd look at the Gemara.
But that's not what the Gemara means. Because, wait till the rest.
My Ovid light. Let's say you want to give the cookie to the kid in the playground. What should you do? How are you going to tell the mother that you've given the cookie to the child?
So the Amar Abaya. Abaya says,
Sha'ifle nishcha umali le kuchla.
Again, do not do this at home. If you give a cookie to a child in the playground, and you want the mother to know that you've been the benefactor of this gift, what you should then do is take some oil and smear it over the kid's face, and take some, like, blue mascara and put it on the kid's eyes, and send the kid home, and that way the mother will realize that somebody gave the child a gift and figure out who it was who gave it. Now, if that happened to you, what would you do? You'd call the police. Right? Nonetheless, that is what the Gemara suggests. But the Gemara sees one problem in it. It says, V'ha'idna, in today's times, that there are witches and sorcerers out there, that people doing all kinds of magic stuff, and the mother may get, frankly, freaked out by finding this strange material on the child. Anybody remember from Daf Yomi what the Gemara's suggestion is? You can't use the oil and mascara trick, so what do you do?
It's only a few masechtos ago, guys.
Cookie crumbs. Gemara says you take the very gift that you've given to the child, so before you give the kid the cookie, you know, take a little bit of it off, crumble it up, and, you know, smush it in the kid's hair. Mother will be really happy for that. Okay? Come on, you've seen the Gemara before. What does the Gemara mean? I don't even think Art Scroll comments on this one. What does it mean? No guesses? Let me tell you how a cook starts off this piece. First line, Hakarat Tova hi he'amud hamusari hayoter gadol v'nizgav. Hakaras hatov, owning up to favors done to people, is the pillar, the lofty pillar of ethical development. Where do you get this out of cookie crumbs? Where is he coming up with this stuff from? Well, relax. He'll explain himself. Rav Kook explains that the capacity to feel gratitude, to feel a sense of obligation to someone who's enhanced your life, he said it's so important that you see you don't have to be a big tzaddik to have it. I don't know how many of you originally came from Bensonhurst, a neighborhood in Brooklyn, very, very close to Borough Park, where some of us have our roots. I'm not myself, but my wife came from there. Bensonhurst was the Sicily of New York. Right? That's where the mafia basically held shop. That's where they lived. And there were, you know, some qualities we don't admire so much in the mafia, but they made very, very good neighbors. Right? They kept the block clean. They kept the block crime-free one way or another. They were, if you were a neighbor on the block, you needed money, they'd lend it to you even outside the usual conditions. And they were very good to their parents. They were very good to their parents. They had a real sense of hakarat tova, of owning up to what they had received from their parents. They weren't very, very good people. But they too felt the sense of obligation. And we have we have phony philanthropists. We have real philanthropists, people who take sizable sums of money and plow them back to the community, although they're not very good people. They sometimes do it for PR, but not all of them. They sometimes do it because they really want to help. Rav Kook observes that Hakaras HaTov is such an important part of our inner makeup that even people who are not very good people have access to it. But he observes, he says, the tragedy is that it seems to be a lot easier for owning up to and expressing gratitude for the smaller things in life rather than the really important things in life. What are the really important things in life? Life itself. The quality of what life given by HaKadosh Baruch Hu really is. And he says there's a simple explanation for it. A person who is not an Adam Shalem, who is not a complete person, doesn't have the vision or the capacity to understand the richness of life, to understand the fullness of it, to understand what a wonderful bracha it is. So, are we left at a stalemate? No, says Rav Kook. The time will yet come in the evolution of mankind when people will get to a place where they can recognize just how beautiful and rich life is. And what will happen then? The emotion within them will need a peg on which to hang itself. And that peg will be Hakaras HaTov. That is the pathway by which we will create a better world. When man evolves to the point that he is able to recognize the beauty of life and feel a sense of obligation of owning up to that gift, he will want to do something. He'll want to discharge the responsibility, and he'll take that energy and plow it back into bettering the rest of the world. He says in the end that the Jewish idea of social revolution is going to be driven by chesed, by Hakaras HaTov. That's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's game plan. Problem is, of course, how to get there. So he says that this is a long process, that the only way to get there is by nurturing the sense of Hakaras HaTov in individuals, in communities, in letting people know from the beginning as well what the end point is, of having people understand in some small measure the idea of the holiness, the kedusha of life. And that way, over the centuries or generations, the knowledge of what kedusha is, coupled with the growing sense of Hakaras HaTov as man's vision enlarges, eventually gets them to the point of understanding the kedusha of life and doing something with it. He says, now we understand what this whole passage in the Gemara is all about. Let's start with Shabbos. If you had to explain Shabbos to your neighbor who's not Jewish or not from, or you had to explain it to a journalist, some inquiring person, what would we say about Shabbos? Well, we would talk about some of its manifest blessings, of a time of rejuvenation, of the impact it has on us as Jews, of how we couldn't live without it, how it's a time we get together with our families. And I have non-Jews over at my house constantly. My kids used to kid us about the fact that, occasionally they'd be lucky and they'd have a real more traditional Shabbos when the only people around the table were Jewish. I can tell you almost universally, non-Jews get to walk away from a traditional Shabbos table feeling, wow, why did we give this stuff up?
You know, the other 612 maybe wasn't such a bad idea. Glad Christianity relieved us of this. But this Shabbos stuff, they can't believe it. You know, this is like Thanksgiving every week. I once had at my home, actually many times, but one time a group of Presbyterian Korean ministers came, 40 of them. They didn't stay the entire meal. And we couldn't handle that, but they did stay for a pre-Kiddush lecture on what Shabbos is all about. And then they heard the Kiddush, and we explained all of that, and they really wanted to see some of the back and forth between parent and child. And we did some Parsha questions, and I tell a lot of stories about this, but this is not the time. One woman started crying in the middle. And she had to be ushered into the kitchen where she cried on my wife's shoulders. And she said, "I don't know what I did wrong. I devoted my life to the church. And I was a good person. And I tried to share my values with my children. And it didn't work. And how is it that you have all these children sitting around the table, eagerly discussing religion, three generations sitting around the table? Where in the West do you find three generations sitting around the table, talking to each other for a couple of hours and having what to say?" It was tragic. I don't look down upon these people in any manner or form. I just feel so fortunate to be a Frum Yid. I feel this is what Rav Kook meant about the gifts that we have to share with the world. If we had to explain Shabbos, we would use some of that terminology, right? And if that's where you leave it, so you missed the point. There is another element of Shabbos that none of us, or few of us, I know I wouldn't, bother to explain or try to explain, because I don't understand it myself. And that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbeinu. Everything that we would explain about Shabbos and how it works and how wonderful it is and how it keeps the Jewish people alive leaves out one word, and that's Kedusha. It's not on the agenda so much. We have a tough time translating it into English, let alone, you know, really getting a handle around it. That, says Rav Kook, is what Moshe Rabbeinu told the Jewish people. You're going to experience Shabbos. You're going to like it. You'll love the cholent. You'll love the chicken soup. You'll love the kugel. You'll love the zmiris. You'll love the divrei Torah. But I want you to know there's another element in that called Kedusha. It has to do with elevating you, bringing you closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, individually and communally and through history. And if it wasn't presented from day one, if it wasn't put there beneath the surface, that we could relate to it subliminally from the beginning, it wouldn't do the collective job of ultimately redeeming us and redeeming mankind. That's the Matana Tova. Continues Rav Kook. The cookie to the child. The child is the symbol here of the less sophisticated Klal Yisrael, of the Jewish people at earlier parts of our history. When we're given the cookie by the stranger, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but the child can only relate to the cookie itself. The material, the sweetness of the cookie, it tastes good. Shabbos is wonderful. But the one giving the cookie should make it known to the aim, to Knesset, the collective neshama of Klal Yisrael, to Knesset Yisrael, that there's more to it. That beyond the gift of the cookie, there is a development of a relationship from a nosein, from a giver, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who has another plan and another objective. And if you want to let people know that, how do you do that? What did the Gemara recommend? The oil and the blue mascara, the blue paint. Says Rav Kook, you want to explain the inner dimension of Shabbos, the part of Kedusha that we must begin to relate to, even if subliminally, so that ultimately in the course of time it can build up. You can explain it a little bit. You can enhance a little bit. You can do it by concentrating on
parts of Shabbos that people don't recognize, how much more comfortable, in a spiritual sense, Shabbos makes us. That's what the oil. Oil was always a symbol of making life more enriched and more comfortable. And the blue on the eye means to enlighten the eye so that they can see things that they otherwise wouldn't. In other words, explain the inner dimension of Shabbos as best as we can. With that explanation, ultimately we build one generation after another. So we realize the fullness of the Kedusha, and therefore we become the complete people, and therefore we can realize the gift, and we can turn Hakarat Tova, the sense of gratitude, into this engine for social revolution. And then comes the Korka. V'ho'idna. But in today's times, that there are kshufim, that there are magicians out there. We can't use the oil, and we can't use the blue on the eye. What is that all about? What is kishuf? What is magic according to the Gemara? Anybody remember the Gemara's pithy definition of kishuf? The Gemara says it's something which, no, that's not kishuf. That's non-kishuf, halachically. That it's what used, according to Gemara, to subvert palmalia shalmala. It's using spiritual pathways to subvert what HaKadosh Baruch Hu really wants done. Says Rav Kook, sometimes, often, especially in modern times, and he actually doesn't say it, but you understand that that's what he's getting at, that too much explanation is counterproductive. That when you explain to people what Shabbos is about, what do they do with it? They use the explanation as a reason not to observe. They say, I already have that. Or I can get the same spiritual charge by getting together with my family at Mama Leone's every Friday night and playing golf Shabbos morning. They're people who say, and they've been saying it for hundreds of years, we buy into the message of Shabbos. What does it have to do with picking out bones from fish in advance? You'll lose the whole forest for the trees. You guys are stuck on the tail. You're trying to get us to a point that we're already there. We identify with Shabbat, and we have it. You can use the explanation. You can use all of that beautiful articulation as a way of subverting halacha. So this part you're not going to like. What's the last line of the Gemara? Forget the oil and the mascara. What do you use? Crumbs. Cookie crumbs. Me oso hamin. What was the base level of Shabbat? Without all the sophistication, without all the understanding, it's halacha. By practicing the lifestyle of Shabbat, we get certain benefits. Sometimes subliminally, sometimes the kind of stuff we can share with our neighbors, it's there. It's not there if you don't observe Shabbat. But the laws, the lametet melachot, keep us on a certain track. That's what makes the experience on the fundamental level of Shabbat. Says Rav Kook, when they're using the sophisticated explanation as a tool to subvert halacha, you have to add to halacha. I told you wouldn't like this. He says, that the base level of Jewish life is compliance with halacha, and the way to increase understanding and appreciation of Shabbat is to add to it, is to make gedarim, to make gezerot, to add fences around the law. Rav Kook beautifully points to the idea that when everything else fails, when we're a community divided and confused and confounded, what do we share in common? What keeps us as one community, having one common lifestyle, no matter how different we seem to look? It's obedience to halacha. The halachic system itself produces a lifestyle that yields for us the minimum level of Jewish living and that level of bracha. And if you can't get to the mind and the soul directly, then subliminally you can get people to appreciate Shabbat more by adding to halachic complexity. Much as we resist it, much as we say, if the rabbis had stayed out of it and we would just have the dioraisis, Shabbos would be a lot better. Rav Kook says that's not true. He says the Gemara is saying it's not true. That by understanding, when we look at the Shas on our shelves and we see how fat Shabbos and Erevin are, that itself tells us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu valued this enough that all those restrictions are somehow necessary. This is Rav Kook speaking, not B'nai Brak. It adds a different flavor to the halachic system. Okay, I haven't left myself too much time, maybe about another 8 minutes for the second half. This is going to be easier. Rav Kook, again, I beg you, find a way to gain access to it, to look at some pieces. There are people around who can suggest the pieces that are more easily digested. It's just so refreshing and so contemporary. Nesiva Shalom, the Slonim Rebbe, Zecharno Livracha, is contemporary in a different way. In the quest for spirituality, there are many people present company, excepted, of course, who are burdened by failure, who realize that they've tried and they're not the people they want to be and they've tried again. Sort of like all the stuff you hear in Elul every year, but it's true every day of the year. We read all the high-minded stuff and we don't feel that we're really connected. We're not getting out of the system what we should. The Slonim Rebbe, in my mind, is the mirror image of Rav Dessler. Rav Dessler learned in World War I in a Hasidic Beis Medrash. In the disruption of World War I, he had to go to a Chabad Beis Medrash. So even though he came from Kelm, which was a Musa yeshiva, he then spent formative years in a Chabad Beis Medrash. And what he learned there is to sort of take the language of Chassidus, of real overt spiritual vocabulary, and turn it into Musar. The Slonim Rebbe, I believe, does the opposite, does the mirror image of that. He takes Musar and he turns it into Chassidus. And I'm going to share with you one thought. It's my favorite piece in the entire Sefer. As I said, Nesiva Shalom is men, women, all parts of the community, has just taken the community by storm. And behold, Tfutzot Yisrael. And I'm going to share with you a piece from probably the most unlikely place that you'd look for it. The beginning of Bamidbar. You know, the Chumash that has just a bunch of numbers and names and stuff like that that doesn't mean anything to us. So, at the end of Bamidbar, at the beginning of Parshas Naso, we get introduced to my three sons. Right? Three divisions of the house of Levi. Gershon, Kahas, Merari, each one has a different job in the Mishkan. I've seen it all my life. I've been Mar B'Sedra. It never really meant all that much to me. I'm looking forward to, when do we get back to Bereshis, when we get, you know, like all the good stuff. So there's some things about these three sons that you may not have noticed. Of the three sons, if this were Los Angeles, who would get the top billing in the marquee? Clearly, Kahas. Of the three roles, he has the most dramatic. He has the one that gets the most attention. Kahas gets to carry the Aron, the other important appliances, the real stuff that speaks of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his relationship to Kal Yisrael. And below him on the marquee would be Gershon. So Gershon's job is not quite as high profile, but it's still, you know, pretty honorable. And then the also-ran is Merari. Why is Merari also-ran? Merari is the schlepper. All Merari gets to do is to take the heavy boards, the crushing, and move them around. That's about as far from the center of Kedusha as you can get. Then you start to see some interesting things. The Torah itself describes Kahas, the one with the really glamorous job, as Avodah. Gershon is Meleches Avodah, something close to that. I'm missing the line here. I'm not going to take the time. And Gershon is la'avod. They have kohos is avodah. Gershon is la'avod ulamasa. And merari is rak mishmeret masa'am. Only masa. Masa is a burden. So kohos has avod, a glorified service of Hashem. Gershon mixed. And merari, just the schlepping. Just the masa, the burden. Now look at the names. I don't know what kohos means. He offers something, I'm not so excited about it. But look at the other two names. Gershom. What word do you see in Gershom? What else? Make it a three-letter word. Gerish. Which means?
To chase away.
And Merari, what word do you see in Merari? Mar, bitter. Never occur to you? Kohos gets the top billing. Gershon is chased away, and Merari is bitterness. Says the Rebbe, there are three different kinds of service of Hashem. And three different kinds of people, three different types of mood that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us. The days that we can connect directly with the Kelim, with the utensils of Kedusha. We feel a direct connection to Hashem, it's Avoda. We're close to Him, He's close to us, it's terrific. And there are other times when we feel that we are grushim, that we have been sort of distanced by Hashem. The davening really schleps, it doesn't get us anywhere. We try even when we try, we don't get so far. We try to have a nicer Shabbos and it doesn't really get us anywhere. And then a week later things can look good for a while and then things will go bad for a while. That's Gershom, says the Rebbe. When at times we are unlike Kohos, who's immediately in the presence of Hashem, we are driven out of the presence of Hashem. But then there are also people who live Merari lives. What are Merari lives? Where everything is bitterness. Where they try as hard as they want, they never feel the connection. Not on a Shabbos, he says, not on a Yontif, not after they've read the last three art scroll books on improving the quality of your prayer. They just don't get anywhere. And then he goes on to say, I'm not just talking about three different people. And you feel lucky that you're not Merari. We all wind up, at least most of us, going through all three stages. There are times when we are Kohos people. There are times we can go for a couple of years when we're Merari people, when we're Gershom people. And there can be times when we live the life of Merari. And you know what the lesson is? By the end of the Parsha, HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes all three sons, puts them together in this Kol Olam in one Pasuk. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu appreciates the Avoda under any of those conditions. And people have to know that all of these topologies are true. We don't understand why or why we're in this position today or why our next door neighbor is in a different position. But the main thing is that if we're in the Merari position, that what is our job? To plow ahead, to plug on, and to say that if this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from me, all He wants to see is my tenacity, my ability to go on in the face of adversity. That's an avoda that's important to Him. He goes on to say, with this I'll conclude, that for most people, the process is from the bottom up. The first stage in avoda of Hashem is becoming the Merari person, the willingness that even when you can't feel the spiritual benefit, that you do the hard work, you do the grunt work. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu asks of this of me, I don't understand it, I don't feel it, I don't feel I'm getting anything back, you do it anyway. That will lead to a Gershon phase and ultimately Kohos. What you recognize in something like this, and you'll see it almost on every page, two things. And more I could talk about, but two things I'll mention now. One, his insistence that in every parsha of the Torah, the most obscure, where you're not looking for it, where there doesn't seem to be any high-minded objective, he will find what he calls al derech ha'avodah, that there is some message in there for connecting with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He'll find it in every parsha. You can count on it. The other thing is that he is just a tremendous realist. I can't think of others who write about people who feel disgruntled, people whose tefillos aren't working, who feel disconnected, and who talk so consistently about this sense of disconnect. as the Slama Rebbe. He has become the voice of a disconnected generation trying to reconnect with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I urge you to pick up the Sefer, find the Shir, find an MP3. I give a Shir. I used to give a Shir online. You can find at least a little Shir on the Parsha if you go to Torah.org to the Parsha section, advanced. You can get at least the last year's Parsha segments. Thank you.